When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
Well, I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute Productions, the Decade Project, where we go back to films 10 years ago, talk about the resonances, see what kind of impact they had, reflect on whether we've kind of curated, whether they've continued to cut through in this glut of content. And so I'm joined by two of my dearest friends. I've got the internet trailblazer, the only newsman in the movie news biz that still has integrity, the only place I actually go to actually read what the fucking news is. Because every time I try and search for other news, Giant Robot have an exclusive that Adam Driver is going to be in Heat 2. And I'm like, fuck off. It's Garth Franklin is one of my guests. One of my other dearest friends, Mr. Stu Coot, is also here. Former co-host of The Cinephiles, but now just Twitter scamp and pest. And we love him for it.
Man about internet town.
We're here today to talk about a 2013 film which has grown in stature for me personally, from performances to visuals. It's grown in stature pretty much with everyone in the cast. It is 2013's Prisoners.
Anna, wait until we're invited.
Oh, for God's sake, Kella, get the hell in here.
What? He actually sings in the shower. So
I do not.
Yes, you do.
Mommy, can I take Joy to our house?
Wear a hat, please. You're just getting over a cold.
Joy, you wear a hat, too.
Where are your sisters?
I can't find them.
Anna? Joy?
Wait, I checked the entire house. They're not here.
Dad, there was this RV, and they were playing on it. We thought there was someone inside.
You wait here.
Let me go. I couldn't find them!
Detective Loki.
Do you have children, Detective?
I'm gonna find your daughter.
Show me your hands right now!
You put those girls somewhere, Alex.
No.
I know you put those girls somewhere.
He stays in custody until my daughter's found, right?
We have a 48-hour hold on. It ends tomorrow unless we bring charges.
We'll charge him with something.
That boy has never been in trouble, not a day in his life.
Well, this thing's clean. I'd start looking in the woods by the rest stop.
The police said they're letting him go today.
What you doing? Tell me! Well, no! Day 6, and every day she's wondering why I'm not there.
You told us that you could protect us from everything.
Why did you look for my daughter?
Alex.
What in the world did you do?
Someone has to make him talk, or they're gonna die.
We're not gonna help Keller, but we won't stop him either. Let him do what he needs to.
I know you know where they are.
Where's my daughter?
Directed by Denis Villeneuve, written by Aaron Guzikowski, starring obviously Hugh Jackman, Viola Davis, Jake Gyllenhaal, Terrence Howard. I mean, this was a time when you could hire Melissa Leo solely to be evil. Paul Dano, Maria Bello, terrific cast across the board. And yeah, I asked the lads to talk to me. We've done 2 decade projects together. This is our second. I want to start off and just say Prisoners is a movie that I could just solely, if there was nothing else, and there's so much more to offer in this movie, but if there was nothing else but Jake Gyllenhaal's performance as, I'm going to get his name here. It's Detective Loki, funnily enough, after speaking about
old,
Marvel.
Twitches and tats, I call them.
Twitches and tats. Yeah. I could do 20 more Twitches and tats Jake Gyllenhaal movies after this one.
It's so good to see him actually do a performance, like a real, like he's trying, swinging for the fences with it. He's really trying.
I think there's about 5 people in this movie who are swinging, and he is swinging. Lads, how was going back a decade ago to this this kind of, like, I don't know, this feels like Denis Villeneuve's like Insomnia. Like, it's one that gets missed in the big conversation about movies.
It's better than Insomnia.
Yeah.
Can I say I put this, so there's 3 that I would sort of put close to each other. This, Memories of Murder, Bong Joon-ho's Memories of Murder. I put them both above, and you'll hate to hear this, I put them above Zodiac in terms of, because I put,
Different kind of film, different films.
They are, but there's something about everyone always talks about the control that Fincher has. Like, it's almost that psychotic control that he has of the, like, that 100 takes, and it's got to be this, and the right mug has to be the detail. But there's a sense that in Fincher's direction, also say the Coens, there's this. As soon as you start one of their films, you're like, there is a steady hand at the wheel of whatever we're doing. There is a steady hand.
When you're sitting in a chair and you're like, I'm good now. I'm fine. Let's
go. It's all right. Like,
we're
going to get you there. And wherever we're going is with purpose. I always find somehow with Villeneuve, he has this sense of inertia in everything he does, that whether you want to go somewhere or not, it is just going to build. It's there in Enemy. It's there in Sicario. It's there in Polytechnique, like everything he does. They're in Arrival. And throughout this, there is just that sense of that encroaching force behind everyone that, despite whatever they're doing, is just pushing them forward constantly.
Yes.
And I just adore it. And I adore that it's not, like, the scope of it again is just perfect. Like, Gyllenhaal's introduction, where he's like hitting on the waitress or talking to her about, like, her Chinese zodiac sign.
Yeah.
And I love the way he's like, can you hit up the boss to take the thing? And she's like, he won't. He's a rooster. And the way he just looks down and is just like selfish and self-centered. Such a beautiful bit of writing. Just like, oh, like, it checks out. But the other thing, just quickly, I'll touch it, because I have this thought going through my head in that, I mean, everyone at their time, except for Gyllenhaal, basically has to go up, dial up to 11 at some stage, either For the women, they either have to go cliche catatonic.
Yes.
Or for the men, they have to go big the other way. But there was something that just struck me of how Hugh Jackman, how perfectly cast he was in using his size and how ineffective he was. Like I kept getting thinking back to like the Batman Joker fight of like,
oh yeah, yeah, where it's like, you know, all your strength, whatever. Yeah.
And you can't do anything. Like you can't save your daughter and you're this big hulking guy, but at the same time that he can make it like, they're able to make it his crux as well, that I should be able to do something because I'm
prepared. Like, I'm a guy who is prepared for the end of the world. I'm a survivalist. Yeah. And so now that I'm faced with a situation, everything that I do, every faculty that I have, I cannot get past this twisted thing.
Like Christopher Reeve.
But you understand the thought process of that.
Yes.
That's the whole thing. Yeah, the film, you get why a guy thinks like that and why he does the actions he does.
Oh, but also like this takes the most cliche, like, I mean, we've got a child on the way. Blake, you got two kids. I think anytime Garth, you've got your niece and nephew, like anytime you've got a person that says, oh, what would you do if your kid got stolen? Like if your kid got kidnapped, what would you do? The cliche male thing is I'll kill them. I'll kill everyone. I would do anything to get them back. And it's fascinating this, how people just use the police predominantly as like the captain says, like, we're garbage men at the end of the day, but they're like, just do your job. Just go out, like solve the murder, like make it happen now. Because if you don't, I'm taking matters into my own hands. Cause that's what everyone would, you know, in the sort of cliche question 101 of like, what would you do if your kid gets stolen? Everyone goes, I'd kill a person. If anyone touched my kid, I'd kill them.
Yes.
And it's interesting to see that play out with like how
Terrence Howard has like one of the best parts of that stuff.
Yeah.
When he's got the hammer and he's taking out that bathroom with Paul Dano, the look on Terrence Howard's face going, what the fuck am
what
I
the
in?
Fuck are we what are we doing? Like,
yeah.
It is incredibly hard to watch. And also then that's what I say, like Maria, there's a great interplay between Maria Bello, who I think does, like you said, in some ways you could say it's thankless, that thankless like catatonia, but they just do enough, they sprinkle enough and season enough like true bits of paranoia as the encroaching world of the impacts of these kidnappers and child murderers, like, basically starts to, be like a noose that's around this entire town. Do enough with her that make her really fantastic. So I don't want to miss out on her talking about it. I just also want to shout out, like, we already know that Viola Davis is one of the greatest actors that has ever walked the face of the earth.
Ever.
And she in this movie, especially when faced with these choices, is able to bite down on her lower lip, so to speak, and like go in, and Terrence Howard's like, I can't make the choices you're going to make. And she's like, oh no, I'll make him. I'll burn this guy. I'll torture him. I'll do anything. Yeah. And she's just like, all the morale, she's just complete amorality comes over. It becomes like lizard brain shit where like people do this. And I think that it's ugly, but it's necessarily ugly movie in those respects. And it's very candid with its ugliness. And I really love it. Garth,
but that's kind of the point of the whole movie, where it's like you're essentially torturing a mentally disabled person.
Yes.
For a perceived act of horror.
Suspicion.
Suspicion, basically.
Yeah. I want to say that's one thing I love about this movie is that it does such a fantastic job, and I have to credit the script, and I want to just shout out his name again. It's Aaron Gizikowski. He does such an amazing job of, in the background of the movie, you hear about a novel, about like a memoir of the Invisible Man or something like that, where someone has written their account of being kidnapped and they escaped from this person. So it's like, it becomes law, but law as in L-O-R-E, law of this town, that there is, this has happened. And then it's a preacher who makes a moral decision, if you like, hearing that someone is like, I've kidnapped and I've killed children and I'll kill again. So he kidnaps someone and murders them and leaves their, rotting corpse in his in his basement. And like, after already being a preacher that has maybe had some, or at least the connotation of child molestation on him. And then you've got the absolutely phenomenal David Malchian, who plays Bob Taylor in this, who is a guy that is utterly traumatized for his entire life and is trying to make meaning of all of the trauma. And he's sort of living this weird, protracted, strange life that kind of comes in and messes things up because, like, he starts going on the trail of this person and then some people think he's the killer. And it's like this entire mystery, it's you are putting the puzzle pieces together of just how large scale and how much it's touched many people's lives and how the ways that they've touched it, it all tangentially, again, I think it coalesces so beautifully, but I just remember watching that and being like, man, does this film do such a great job of saying laser focus on the story it is trying to tell and not being bogged down and going into a digression and just like mentioning it in the background or mentioning it in a conversation and mentioning it and just stays with that forward momentum. And all these distractions become distractions from solving the murder and so solving the case of these missing girls. And I really love this.
That's the great thing with Gyllenhaal though, is that his whole backstory, it's just one offhand mention about how he's raised in a boys' home.
Yes.
And when he's like torturing the priest. And then you just, then it starts little things with his, you know, the collar done up, with the tattoos, with the twitches and all that sort of stuff. There's a lot of stuff there. It never dwells on it. You're making a big backstory for Loki. It's all just these little inference at different points. And it's, yeah, that's really, really strong. Everybody has trauma in this movie.
Yeah, but you're right about the way they do Gyllenhaal because, the collar is perfect. The fact that he wears the same clothes every single day is one of those, like, this is my uniform, this is one of my disciplines. Like, he could be a Paul Schrader character or I got sort of those vibes of sort of, in a longer story, this becomes True Detective, and we go back to your empty unit where you've only got a cross.
Oh yeah,
and a couch, but we don't.
And a tiny circular mirror for some reason to look into your own eyeball.
Yeah.
But that's the big.
They don't give into that. And also, the relationship with his captain is like he gets a lot of rope to speak to him quite, in that sort of chain of command sort of thing where he's like, can you fucking get out of my way and do my job? And the captain says, it's very funny when Maria Bello brings it up after that, she has her first meeting with Loki and she breaks up at that trope of like, your captain said you've solved every like case you've ever had. And she bursts out laughing, but you also like, you can exactly see that podunk captain has said, don't worry, love, I've got my best man on the job. He solved every case. But at the same time, Loki probably did, because we see how thorough he is and how he just doesn't actually have an agenda. He's just going where he gets called and follows the next thing that's up. He doesn't try and paint anyone into a corner. He just follows where the evidence is. The other smart thing is it doesn't go, and it's not this story, doesn't really do anything with the media or the hysteria of the town. It doesn't even touch on that. It just, he goes, there's a media scrum following around. That's it. When no reporters overstep their mark, we don't really even see much. We see vans come and go. It doesn't sort of turn into, because the year after this, it was a great time for candlelit vigils and line searches of forests, because we had Gone Girl the next year.
Yes.
And so we had a lot of those like searching for body sort of looks that they were. But whereas Gone Girl was very much playing in the media.
Gone Girl is camp. Yeah.
It is. But that had, this just had that, you could just infer from the nice writing. But I think my nicest touch in this is when he's doing the first interrogation of Paul Dano, how it was silently cutting to the crime scene analysis of the RV.
Yes.
Just splicing in complete silence of like, the water dripping off. I just love that idea that forensically there is no agenda. All that these texts come down in the middle of the night. There's a piece of tree through they don't actually know what's happened. And all they're there to go, are there fibers? No, there aren't we can't even tell you what to make of that. All we're saying is there aren't any fibers, but if there was a struggle, there'd be fibers. All right, next, I just love how clinical it is and cold it is at times. And then at other times there is a lot of humanity at play. I loved it. I love this so much. And
We haven't mentioned his name yet. Roger Deakins.
Oh, well, yeah. That's a whole other thing.
That's a whole other story of this movie.
You could write essays on that tree shot. You could write essays on that drone shot over the dam.
Yes.
There's a shot where even the arrest at the beginning where they're like the blue and red.
Even there's a shot where him and the son are running back in the rain, and the way the rain is falling down on that cul-de-sac kind of thing is just I'm just looking at it going.
It's that shot where the RV is parked at the petrol station.
Yeah.
And you're seeing Gyllenhaal walk up to it in the rain and his silhouette. And I'm just like, this is fucking gorgeous. It looks like $10 bazillion. It's like Denny's just like, I know I'm shooting this in like a fucking podunk town in Canada, playing for some slice of American suburbia, but man, I'm gonna shoot the living fucking daylights out of this if I have Roger Deakins, because he will just do it. And the editors, Joel Cox and Gary Roach, you just talked about that great scene of the intercutting. I just think the editing at times is surprisingly deft at passing along a lot of information with just visuals of things that they've shot, like, you know, like that. And then other times is so glacially perfect and slow and deliberate that you're just like, this is just sensational. It just slowly goes along and just very calm. It's excellent.
And full props to the score as well on this one.
Johanna Hannison. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, yeah. Amazing.
He's passed, hasn't he? Did he pass a couple of years ago, or was it the...
Yes, he did. No, you're absolutely spot on.
Yeah, he did.
He's done some terrific scores. If you did Villeneuve, you're a fan of things like, he obviously did Prisoners, and he did...
Did he do Enemy?
He did Arrival. I'm just going to see if he did Enemy as well. No, it doesn't look like he's done Enemy. I'm just trying to see if there's others that we may be...
It's a haunting score.
Yeah, a lot of European flicks. He ended up doing Mary Magdalene, which was the Aussie...
Oh, yeah, the Joaquin Phoenix one. Okay.
Yeah, the Garth Davis, who's an Aussie filmmaker who made Lion, he followed it up with Mary Magdalene with Joaquin Phoenix and Rooney Mara. And the production of that movie, the look of it, the feel of it, even the cast of it was quite good, but it probably didn't land 100%. But man, such a terrific score. Loved this. And the production design as well. Patrice Vermette was the production designer. I'm just going to see if she's done other... it's Patrice, as in a man. Patrice, he's done Dune. He did Sicario. He had a hand in... oh my God, what a freaking resume. He had a hand in Enemy as well.
So he's Villeneuve's backup.
He's Villeneuve's guy. terrific 2011 movie Cafe de Flore, which I think is a special movie as well. But like that production design, especially in the house when the snakes are crawling over Loki's
head.
That is a fucking outlandishly insane scene.
And especially because like with all the like, all those like the spirals on the wall,
on hand drawn on all the walls in the house,
could easily not work. Like that could look almost too tropey about the crazed person. But again, I can never pronounce that the guy that's playing who he arrests there. But if they ever did a John Cazale movie, he should play John Cazale. Like if you throw like a bit of a bald cap on him, I think that could work really well.
David Dastmalchian, and he's in everything.
He pops up all the time.
And he goes from this into Ant-Man, where he's sort of playing the Russian hacker. I think he had a role.
He's in Dune as well. He's got a smaller role.
Blade Runner 2049. He had Blade Runner.
In Blade Runner 2049 as well. And he's in Suicide Squad.
So just very, as an anecdote, I work with a bloke who his favorite film, we get talking about movies, and because I have a quote from Aliens on my cubicle about like the every day's about every meal's a banquet, every paycheck's a fortune. And he noticed it. We get talking and he goes, look, my favorite movie, and I've seen it, and I count it every time I watch it, is Blade Runner. And he said, I've seen it 153 times. I was at the premiere in Sydney in 1982 when it came out.
And
I've been obsessed ever since. And I said, oh, funny, have you seen Blade Runner 2049? The director is, I think, arguably like top five working actors at the moment. He goes, no, I can't do it. I love the other one too much. And I, every time, I've been wearing him down now for a year. Last weekend, he finally watched it. And he came in yesterday into work and he goes, I watched it. I think I've got to watch it about another 100 times now to catch up. because there is such reverence and there is such a power and everything behind it. And I just think that there's something, there is those, the control of like those glacier-like movements that Villeneuve has at times. And even when he shoots action, it's still, like even the car chase.
That car chase at the car at the end. And the rain streaming down the...
And the blood area his face.
And the blood streaming down his eye and the way he's looking back. It's we didn't talk about it in Iron Man, but it was one thing. The terrific, sensational film, which I've only now watched about... I've only probably watched through like two or three times, but I've watched the Natu Natu dance about 1,200 times because my son, Keith, loves it so much. I showed it to him one day and he's like, it is the coolest thing ever. RRR, he's the great director, S.S. Rajmouli, goes, I really love superhero movies. I just wish they'd slow down their action so I could see what was going on. And he said it with love. He said it with love, like as a director who's like, I tend to like, I said it and I don't like cutting away too much. And he's like, the most he's ever cut a scene is the dance in Natu Natu because he's cutting for effect and to punctuate background actors and to punctuate different movements. And it's like that true like animation action direction, if you like, because it's like you're just taking the mood of the song and it's more like shooting a film clip for a song, a music clip. But he's like, if you look at even the action in RRR, which is as patently ridiculous as a superhero movie, is so sensational and elevated because it takes its time and you watch these huge scenes unfold and it really loves bodies in motion and physicality and all those things. And Villeneuve is not a great action choreographer necessarily. It's like, oh, you look at him, you're like, oh man, God, look at all this. But man, when there's action in his stuff, any kind of action, because he's got Deakins there, shit just happens. He sets it and it just happens. It's great.
We understand the geography of action. There's geography with action scenes where you understand where all the players are and how everything's falling out. And he understands that. There's so many directors these days that just don't. Really don't.
It's even the tension to the way, like he'd tuck the camera in behind Gyllenhaal anytime he was going to pull his weapon out.
Yes.
Like you would, like, and it was such a short, sharp movement that you're like, this guy is so experienced. He's at times you worry about if he's reckless because he's clearly sort of like the way he goes into the caravan where you're like, someone has to go in, but why are you going gung ho? You don't really know what's in there. He jumps straight into like when he's breaking into the house at first Hugh Jackman, his dad's old house. There is a slight recklessness to him that he goes in by himself to all these things, but you also get
the running through the yards when he's running through the yards after our boy David Dalmastian. It's like he's running through the yards, and you're like, that scene fucking messed me up this time. I was watching it, and I was like, oh, why? I know you've got to chase this guy, but it's just not good. It's not fun. It's
But it gives you a sense that he can handle himself. Like he's not a they don't ever have him doing big punch outs or like any big wrestling. He's just a man. Which is good because it brings it back to that sort of reality because he's giving away a few kilos to probably most crooks on the street sort of thing. But there's something I really like that sort of the blink, like those little touches on Gyllenhaal work quite well. I think, the tats, like you say, the tats work really well. The haircut, it is a man of
discipline. Yeah, he's not like the Hitler youth with the black hair.
And a man that has probably did, like I sort of got a bit of a sleeper's vibe as well.
The
sense that he'd been abused as a child.
That was pretty clear.
And it may have been the reason he joined the police, and it may have been
That's the whole thing with the twitching. It's like initially you're wondering if it's a drug thing, but then it sort of is obviously not because it goes on through more theories, and then you start wondering what caused this, and whether this was, you know, kind of born condition or whether this was something he sustained from. And then when the boys home stuff comes in, you're wondering, it's like, okay, was this, has this guy been abused? Is this why he's so chasing these sort of guys?
I have to admire the shit out of him, because he modulates that, he establishes that this character has tics. And that's the reflections of the trauma, right? That's the manifestation of the trauma coming out. But I love that, like, in certain sequences, especially when he closes proximity between him, sometimes it goes, but sometimes it picks up. And the way that it has like a real narrative cohesion to why he's doing it is great. And it's funny, like, the show, basically the best talk show online, Hot Ones, right? Like, Gyllenhaal recently was a guest on Hot Ones, and he talked about prisoners, and he goes, Sean Evans, the great host there, is like, oh, I really love Danny Villeneuve and I really love Prisoners, and can you tell me about making that movie, because, you know, I think your performance is spectacular. And he goes, oh, thank you. And he's like, when we read that, like, on the page, Loki was like, he didn't have some of that stuff on the page. Like, he could have been played as a straight-A character. And he said, when I read it, I kind of looked at it and I was like, I have so much opportunity to really, like, swing for the fences. And Villeneuve is a director who, you think, man, he's tackling these absolutely monstrous projects. Usually he's tackling big budgets. He's tackling big egos. Like, he's worked with Taylor Sheridan as one. He's worked with Harrison Ford another. Like, I mean, even though Harrison Ford's a damn god at this point, but it's like, he's worked with these things. He's tackling Dune, which must be the most intimidating thing of all time. Everyone and their dog has failed at making that movie. And he made Part One. Pretty stone cold banger of a movie, if you ask me. But man, just to give him the trust after working with Jake on Enemy and being like, yeah, just swing for the fences, bro. Go absolutely hard. Do whatever you want. Like, do whatever you think is going to make sense. And he just does such a spectacular job. He's just amazing. I can't get enough of Loki. Like, I could watch just a highlight reel of him in this movie over and again. He's great.
This is also the interesting point for Gyllenhaal, because he just done the Prince of Persia thing about 2 years before, and that was his real sort of last attempt at trying some big studio thing.
Yes.
And that was a kind of bit of a disaster sort of thing. So it feels like he has something to prove, and he carries that on. He did this, then he did Enemy, then he did Nightcrawler, then he did Southpaw, I think, after that, and most of the stuff. So this was that sort of period where Gyllenhaal was felt like he was
source,
really
source code around this time. Like this.
Yes, source code.
It was about
is
a year or two before.
He goes incredible. He goes Zodiac, Rendition, Brothers. Then he does Prince of Persia, Sands of Time, because, you know, they were like, we're still trying to make Jake Gyllenhaal happen. The same time he does Love and Other Drugs.
Rendition and Brothers didn't really work either.
They didn't work. He does Love and Other Drugs, which was big-ish for the time, but kind of fell away. He does Source Code. And then after Source Code, he goes End of Watch, Prisoners, Enemy, Nightcrawler.
End of Watch is the start of the
And then he does a couple of other biggish ones. He does Southpaw and Everest, and then he does Demolition, which I quite enjoyed. 2015 little movie. Does Nocturnal Animals with Tom Ford.
Great film.
Then he has Life, underrated, super fun popcorn alien flick. Okja, Stronger, and then, like, he starts going into more weird and wonderful stuff. Wildlife, Sisters, Brothers, Velvet Buzzsaw, pops into Spider-Man Far From Home, does his
has a ball,
and then now he's into things like The Guilty, Ambulance, which he's having an absolute fucking wild time, and is in now The Covenant, which I'm really excited. Guy Ritchie's new flick.
It was funny, as we're looking at this 10-year thing, I went to watch this and I was like, oh, I'm pretty sure I own it on Blu-ray. No, I don't.
The same thing with me. I thought I had
I'll go and buy it. And I was like, it's not anywhere. And this was like one of those things going, how the hell is this not, I don't have a 4K of this.
How like, don't I have a 4K of a Denis Villeneuve movie is a fucking great question to ask.
And it's only 10 years. Like, in terms, and then we always talk about these conversations with physical media, and I was like, have I just been missing it when I swear I've seen it available at JB over the years and just never.
I have a Blu-ray. I have a Blu-ray, and I instinctively went to watch it on the telly in the lounge room, because I know that despite the fact that the movie, especially now with kids, you talked about, you've got one on the way. Garth's the best uncle in the world to a great niece and nephew. And I've got my two. I'm like, the fucking kid stuff in this stuff is tough, but my wife likes Danny Villeneuve movies enough and likes Jake and likes Hugh Jackman. It's like, it's one and loves Viola. So we can get away with kind of watching it even with the tough bits in the movie. So I went to just watch it out in the lounge room. I didn't have it. I was like, oh, cool. I guess I have to go back to my Blu-ray. Mm. And I came in and thankfully I look at my shelves now and I'm like, fucking thank God, because it's like, how does a movie that is this good? And even like, I know we were just sort of joking about Insomnia before, saying it's a lesser Nolan. You can't fucking find that movie anywhere. It's so hard to find. It's Nolan movie. How the fuck?
Yeah.
It's a Christopher Nolan movie with Robin Williams and Al Pacino and Hilary Swank. How can I find that?
And
fucking
it's Warner
movie?
Brothers picture. It's not like it was one of these smaller distributors.
It's insane. It's like, for the longest time, The Insider, Academy Award nominated The Insider with Russell Crowe and Al Pacino. It was so hard to get in international regions. Fortunately, in Australia, there's like a little Blu-ray you can get. But like, I don't get it. Like, that's the other thing I think are going to come up in these topics is like, some of these fucking movies are hard to find.
Oh yeah.
And it's what is decreasing. Like, I think JB they've kind of pivoted into certain things over this last 10 years.
Yes.
But there was a time when you would have expected to have a sale every other day for physical media. There wasn't even really a thought. Now, this iTunes was probably running up in, was iTunes for movies running in 10 years ago like this?
Yeah.
Yes, it was. But it was still, it wasn't like, didn't have the kind of range like it has now.
No.
Yeah, it's just interesting. As we said with Iron Man, like all these industries that have sort of, like my first thing was, because I don't, like it was just to go, all right, well, I'll, you know, just check. Like I've got Just Watch. I live on Just Watch for all these sort of things. And it was like, all right, well, I guess I'm just buying it on iTunes now. And I was like, oh, I really don't like that thought either. That like, this is one of those ones that you do want to have the sort of,
I want to have disc. I want to check out the special features. I want to see if Villeneuve's talking. I want to see Roger Deakin. I want to watch a behind-the-scenes camera on Deakins and Villeneuve having a conversation. That's what I want. Because like, I'm dying for it.
Where are you guys on the actual conversation of Villeneuve? Is it, are you, I have him sort of top five working, like it began to my head between, at times, between him and Nolan. I think he brings a sense of the humanity, and he has a bit more of a biting edge than Nolan.
He's certainly more of a human director than Nolan. Like Nolan always runs a bit cold.
But I think Villeneuve can be cold in the sense of like,
yeah, but it's not quite the same. It's a different. Nolan's always much more sort of intellectual, trying to figure things out, puzzle kind of guy.
Yeah.
Whereas Villeneuve's a bit more of a heart there.
But he holds the mirror, I think, up to society a bit more, whereas Nolan is a bit more spectacle. Villeneuve is actually like, you do make wrong choices. There are bad people, bad things happen to people, and he'll put that mirror up, and there's a sense of inevitability about the badness. but I think in terms of appointment viewing, he is.
Oh, and I'm approaching
the top five.
So I love Prisoners, but after Sicario, I'm like, I will see. Like, so I think Enemy was harder to get in Oz, and I don't know if we watched.
But Enemy was also more of the classic art house indie kind of film.
Yeah, so you
still see that kind of stuff more. Whereas this is the big thing with me with this movie was that you don't see films like this anymore.
No,
this is the mid-budget adult drama sort of thriller that's really, really polished, really kind of thing like that. This thing would be an HBO miniseries these days.
Easily.
It's Mary Beast.
So much, and that's the thing I love is they trim so much fat. It's so economical. And you could tell that it's ripe for digressions, but they're like, no, this is a feature film. We're going to get.
Yeah, it's not that story.
It's not. No. We're not going to go and go Memoirs of the Invisible Man, make it a serial killer, make it just some Netflix trash. Like, no, we're going to make
it. If it was made 15, 20 years before, it'd be a Paramount Pictures 90s thriller.
Yes.
Because if it was made, it's made 10 years later, like I said, it would be an HBO miniseries. Now. It's this kind of thing where it's sort of hit in this.
I think Dune has been my least enjoyable of his just because it felt a bit hollow, but the scope, the grandeur and some of the photography and the scope of things that he puts on, like when they run out, the thing
the trick with Dune is Dune's tricky because, as I said, it's a two-parter. So this is, and he had to get rid of,
maybe.
Well, no, that's too bad, really. But Dune, with that novel, it's
all the exposition is really in that first half. And so this second half, this is going to be more interesting because a lot of it is just, it's almost like a trip. It's a big old sort of hippie dipshit. Stuff like that.
So I hope so, but it just happened. Felt...
Put that on the poster. June 2, a big old hippie dipshit. Garth Franklin, Dark Horizons.
It felt a little bit sort of style over substance, which is maybe the point of June to a certain extent as well, in terms of it's hard to wrangle in. The other stuff have just felt a bit more focused, I guess.
Sicario is fucking outstanding.
It's a lot tricky. Yeah, it's a lot tricky. A lot more scale.
Yeah.
It's very, very hard. It's a very, very hard novel to adapt.
Yeah, super hard to adapt. And I'm not a Dune head, so I really enjoyed it. I thought it was terrific. Sicario, you know, you boys know, because I think we actually saw Sicario together and we were all like, what the fuck is this? This was amazing. Arrival really hit me for six. Didn't see it in the theater for whatever reason. I don't know when it came out in 2016, which doesn't surprise me. If it came out late in the year, that was probably, I would call that like Halcyon Hazel days, that when my daughter was born. So I probably wasn't around to see that at the time that it was in the theater, and I watched it at home, and I was, you know, as a new parent, I was absolutely floored by it. And I was just a puddle by the end of it. I just loved it to pieces. But Blade Runner 2049 was like going to church. That movie was fucking brilliant. It was cathedral-like experience. I've never felt a sense of awe and anticipation and just like emotional investment in a story in an audience. I've rarely felt that sitting in a theater the way that I felt it in Blade Runner 2049. And then just the deep satisfaction that he actually landed the plane on a movie that seemed like an impossibility was incredible. And then going into Dune, which took a couple of years to make because he made some things in pretty quick succession, obviously in a much smaller scale, less reliance on budget, less reliance on, you know, huge marketing campaigns, etc. But you know, we get Dune in 2021, you know, a post-pandemic, as a sort of like late 21 banger, and now we're going to get Dune Part 2, and I'm just like, yeah, I'm down for him. I think he's a terrific director. Sicario again, I don't know what I've watched more. It might just be Sicario because it's a little bit less emotionally grueling, but I've certainly watched Sicario, Blade Runner, like countless times at this point. I don't even know how many times. Like, just I've always watched like 20 minutes of them, 30 minutes of them, an hour of them when I get a minute. If I don't know what to watch, he's a very good director.
Also, if you ever have someone new starting at your work and their head is spinning, it's so good to be able to tell them you're worried about how the clock works. I'm just trying to teach you how to read time. And I think it showed why, with him not being there for Sicario 2, which has grown on me with multiple viewings, I think that you see what he would have brought to it, I think, if he had had that to do a bit more with. I think it's...
Yeah.
Sicario 2 is not a bad movie. It's actually it's a good action movie, but it's not Sicario the first one.
It's not the first one, no. Yeah.
That first one where Emily Blunt rolls up, when she rolls up with Daniel Kaluuya in that truck for that first fucking scene, it is... special movie, man. Special.
Yeah, Deacon's doing the whole thing with the trip down across the border.
Oh, into Juarez. Oh, Jesus Christ, that's good. Oh boy.
And that's the thing. Like, even in Prisoners, like I say, everyone gets their 11 moment. Like, Melissa Leo she's simmering at like 15.
Melissa Leo lives at 15. You are right. That's so funny. Yeah. Let's have a look at Melissa Leo's career at that time. So Melissa Leo, let's get pre-Equalizer 2, and let's get down to like the 2010s, 13s. So all right,
Olympus Has Fallen was around that time.
Okay, so Melissa Leo is in one
reading
of my,
she's reading the Pledge of Allegiance when she's getting dragged to the
helicopter, whatever. Yeah.
All right, Melissa Leo. She does a spectacular turn in Red State, one of Kevin Smith's best movies in my mind. Does a great turn in that. Does she win an Academy Award for Alice Ward in The Fighter?
No, but she should have.
No.
Oh, she's great in The Fighter.
That was a small.
She pops into Flight. She's in Olympus Has Fallen. Yeah. She's Sally in Oblivion. Are we in Effective Team? Around this time, she pops into Treme for that series, a terrific series if you haven't seen it. She's in The Equalizer. Yeah. She's in The Big Short. She's
Gone Baby Gone? Is she in that? Or is in Gone Baby Gone?
That was literally, no. Frozen River was when she came in. That was
Frozen River. That's
after.
Yeah, so she does a couple of films, and then she's like bouncing back to TV and then bouncing back to films. She's been doing voice work. She was in BoJack Horseman for a couple of episodes. She's in Snowden, which is a pretty decent movie. It's not out of this world. It's very watchable. She's in Equal. Continues to be in the Equalizer series, and
she dies in the second one. That's the whole thing. It sets up the plot.
Yeah, and so she's got a bunch of other things that are on the way. But yeah, she's really going for it in this period. She's absolutely just like, she's sensational.
So it feels like a bit of carryover from Prisoners for Dano into the Batman to an extent.
Oh, but Dano's been doing that sort of stuff for a while. It feels like he's been doing that sort of weirdo sort of slightly.
It's a different thing. Yeah,
she did win for The Fighter. She won a best supporting actress in The Fighter, and in Frozen River, that was her previous nomination. She was nominated in 2009 for that.
Yeah,
but when they take that fucking hood off Paul Tano's head,
that one is just swelled up. Yeah.
Oh man, I think it's really smart to have us as the audience second guess, do we guess? Mm. Do we accept what was said at the parking lot, or is that in his head? Is that like Hugh Jackman wants to hear that? But then when he like strings the dog up at the end of the street, just when he's walking the dog at night, and it's like that smartly for us as the audience to go, okay, well, whoa, maybe there is, like, maybe we do have a Usual Suspect style situation. But then, and then to sing the song. There are so many nice little touches like that.
Mm.
And then the other one through the pipe about they were smiling.
I've loved Paul Dano since he was Klitz in The Girl Next Door.
Oh, yes, I remember that, yeah.
But it's great. I still think Terrence Howard's really good in it.
Terrence Howard's a great actor.
Those little touches, like with him playing the trumpet and all that sort of, like, the Thanksgiving stuff. Even the hunt, like, even just starting it with the hunting scene. Just that sort of notion and the dead deer in the back of the truck, like, and shooting it through the wind.
Dylan Minnette. Yeah, he's the kid. He's the son. And that's one of the interesting sort of roles that gets glossed over. This one is the son where they sort of, he has him that bit where he confronts the dad about him being, you know, just going off and getting drunk. I'm stuck here looking after mum while she's collapsing, essentially.
I love that of like, no, I'm doing the Lord's work at the old house. And you're like, all right, but how much are you just getting pissed?
Ignoring your responsibility.
But how much are you getting pissed to as the torturer?
Yes.
Knowing that you're in pure denial that it's actually helping. And that he's gonna break again. That's smartly done. And it's again well informed that it's over what a seven day period, because they talk about like they get to 6 days when nothing's happened and that's when he blows up.
Yeah.
And so yeah, maybe 7 days. It's very smartly the way it keeps without having the official counter of like day two, day three. The other thing on this watch,
it only sort of falls apart sort of at the end, like Leo's with the sort of the explanations and so sort of, and reveals at the end. It's a little cliche, out of a James Patterson novel kind of thing.
A bit of Scooby Doo, like you know, you finally got away. The other interesting take is, and a different movie may have gone down this path, that it had nothing to say that it was a young white girl and a young black girl that went missing, and they never looked at, like, there was never
a racism element.
It wasn't a racial.
There was never if it was a young white girl stolen, like taken, you'd have all the, like, regardless, they go, we've got every uniform officer in the state looking for these kids.
Yeah.
It just very smartly doesn't pick any battles that it doesn't need to necessarily take, like you say, the delineations away from the main story.
Well, yeah, it's very careful about that. Yeah, not just the racism stuff, but also the sexuality sort of stuff as well. Loki, you never see anything about a sort of romantic life, anything at all in that character. You're wondering if he's sort of...
Yeah.
Because of the abuse, has that informed in his sort of things? Was he Is he gay? Is he asexual? What do we don't know?
Yeah, and if you take that as almost, is it flirting with the waitress at the beginning, or is it just he's got an inquisitive
like
flirting,
it just seemed like a straight, it just seemed like a straight conversation. Yeah,
yeah, and he just and you get the sense that you know he's there on Thanksgiving. No, again, no family to go to.
Yeah, exactly.
He's eating Thanksgiving dinner in like a highway diner / Chinese restaurant sort of thing. Like that idea of that loneliness and that dedication. I love the little touches as well of the things happening when he's in his car and he's like just trying to do his job, and like Hugh Jackman comes out and he's like, oh shit, what now?
Shit.
Yeah. And he's like, oh fuck, I'm just like, I'm literally just trying to do my job and all these people are getting in the way of me doing. I don't think I think again, it's that coping mechanism of like, I don't see, and again, it ties into the maze portion. I don't see any humans around me. I just see riddles and problems I need to solve.
Yes.
And the way I solve the riddle or the problem is to catch the killer, find the missing child, like find the thing. It's almost like a way, it goes back to sort of true detective style.
There's a couple of bits that are cliched, but they're perfectly, perfectly tweaked versions of the cliche, which is like in so many movies, you see the cop or the detective trash their desk. Right.
Oh yeah.
They trash their desk and they're like, fuck it. And then it just cuts to the next scene. But I love that in this movie, you see him trash his desk. You actually see a little bit of the fallout in the office. Like, oh, there's Detective Loki, this big city cop douchebag fucking carrying on again, like a pork chop. Like we've had enough of him. And then the camera floats from that sort of God's eye POV over the top of him, and you just see he's amazing. You know, he's this sort of weird, contorted, frustrated, almost like, I don't know, like he's just like possessed body, and the fallout of all of the investigation papers on the ground, and then it like triangulates to the photo of of the guy underground with the unsolvable maze spiral, and then the spiral pictures, and then it's like, and then it tweaks to his like the picture of the guy, and he's like, oh shit, like this is what it is. And so he goes to the house, and you know, that's, I just love those touches too, because there's some bits, you know, we love genre movies because they hit on the cliches that we love, and I think that this does such an amazing job of being so firmly in genre, but then it's just like, it just extrapolates and extends these huge genre scenes to like make you deal with the emotional turmoil of like a real situation that this would be unfolding.
And same with the captain when he says to him, like it's quite a jarring jolt when he's like, save it for the fam. Like they don't even let him wallow in the fact that the guy's killed himself in custody.
Yes.
And he's like, save it for the kid's parents.
Yes.
For like when he's got, and it's like, that coldness and that sort of way of dealing with, you know, the darkness that sort of first responders have to have, that sort of, you know, the gallows humor of sort of things like that. Just you're talking about someone
just to get through the day,
just to like deal with it. And they're like that, they're through it. Like even at the beginning when they're like, I don't have the budget to be doing this. I'm sorry that two kidnapped children aren't moving the Richter scale, like and the way Hugh Jackman and they react, and as any parent would, like it's horrific and it's the worst possible thing that could happen. And to the police, it's like it's a Tuesday, and they can't rise and fall on, like he can't actually get emotionally involved in this. Like we are doing everything,
but that's how hospital workers. That's how cops on the front lines. That's how. You can't be a coroner without being a really twisted comedian. You know? Well,
yeah. And there's something to that, though, because it's some, like we said before, that
it's the Billy Connolly joke of like, he's like, he had a close friend who was studying to be a mortician. And he said, like, when they're at university and they take bodies up to the university, as a medical university, so they take bodies from the morgue that had been donated to science and then to use, and people would go home and like go to get their car keys out of a pocket and there'd be a penis in there and stuff like that. Yeah. It's just like the people, it's just like, he's like, oh, for fuck's sake, like, you know, the great Billy Connolly, oh, for fuck's sake, like, just, you know, penis in your pocket. And I'm like, man, that's like, what a familiarity with death to just take the piss out of it. But you kind of have to.
Oh, they do that a lot. Yeah. One of the famous, I think it was Stephen Fry, the famous story where they're like, the coroner was addressing the students and he was like, you know, this is what you do. You put the finger in there and then they had to make the students do that sort of thing. And then he goes like, then you put the suck the finger like this.
Yeah.
Now you notice I put the middle finger was the one I put in and then the index finger was the one.
I was having that conversation with someone the other day. I said, oh yeah, so-and-so used to work at the coroner's court. And they said, oh, did it mess them up? Like seeing all those, like all the dead bodies and everything. I said, no, not really. The only weird thing was like, every time he wanted to have sex with his wife, he'd make her get in an ice bath first and then lay really still.
Sure.
But yeah, I think I've only seen this two or three times.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, as you know, you love your, as I said to you, this could be a 6 or 8, like, series breakdown of this film. I think you'd find enough people that want to come and talk prisoners.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure I necessarily would want to revisit it too many times to go back through this process.
It's a tough,
it's a great watch.
It's so amazing, but it is so nakedly candid with the awful inhumanity of desperation that it's not super fun. Like, that's totally why I can understand, like, in the last decade particularly, it's like all the things we've already said. Number one, an absolutely amazing all-star cast. Number two, a really terrific premise, a great script, a studio that's funding a director who they clearly have a belief in and see higher potential for, and see sort of like that great, like, they've made independent movies, they've made smaller scale movies, let's sort of gradually increase as they're like kind of going up to the majors, you know, like an old boxing trainer with like a guy that has a lot of potential. They're trying to pick opponents for them to like keep, you know, to manage the risk of like eventually throwing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars at them to do this gigantic thing. And so you can totally see, oh, okay, they're just managing their thing. They're just moving them up. Yep. Okay. Gotcha. But unlike something like Sicario, which is, you know, you can almost write off as, even though it's not, but people can sort of write it off as like, oh, it's like folly. It's like, you know, contemporary war stuff. It's got a little bit of extremity. It's got a little bit, maybe less believability. I actually think it's got just equally the amount of believability as Prisoners, but you can see that it's a little bit more like calm, as like violence between drug kingpins and people and, you know, and police doesn't seem to move the needle. You're a pro. So if you get knocked around, that's your job. But man, this movie just wallops you. It wallops you. And then even though the ending is deeply satisfying in many ways, it's also like, I don't know if I can go back through that just to get the relief. Like, I don't know if I can go back through it to get the relief.
Yeah, it's just strange.
Yeah, there's a shot here, the scene with that where he does the shower torture stuff. It's like, oh man, that, yeah, you know, you hear the screaming and just obviously Deakins just has that shot of the eye.
Yes.
In the hole, and it's like, oh my god.
Because I almost don't know if it needed the whistle at the end as well. I don't know if he needed it to be like, if you almost could have done somehow with the sound design to be the whistle through the tree as opposed to the actual whistle. Like, I don't know if, because the redemption for what Hugh
Jackman's
is,
never getting any redemption. He's going to jail.
No, he's going to prison, basically.
When he goes out of that hole.
He goes knowing that he didn't get his daughter back. Like, it wasn't his actions that led to that.
Which is even more torture that he's going to go to jail. He did all that stuff, and it didn't actually instigate that action. It was just Loki.
And he was right. He was right about the.
He was right
putting it together, like, but just couldn't get the, but the yeah, right answer. But I didn't like you working out.
You know, the other big thing is like, I heard you. You were there.
Yeah, that was. You were there. And not to and be that again, that the fact that he's burdened with his daughter, he has to get it back. His dad left him. His dad was a piece of shit. So he had to make amends. And as equally as we learn about Gyllenhaal's life, I think there's the nice touches to Hugh Jackman's dad is a nice way to do it as well. Like, I knew your dad. Yeah, okay, cool. Someone in the police knew him. All right, now it's a suicide. Now it's this. And again, may have been the abusive as well when we think about that's why you're a prepper, because your dad was prepping. Your dad was doing that as well. So your dad might get the sense that he was potentially a mean or a strict man. And there would have been, I get the sense there was a bit of discipline around the house as well, being from like a prison warden or a prison guard, that kind of thing, maybe bring work home and tap, like hitting the kids or his mum around. I like that all these like inferences can be made against all these people to how they ended up here. But
that whistle at the end, you know, as much, and that's, I think it's kind of a,
it just puts a, it puts a bow on it, because we're left, otherwise we're left with, he's out there somewhere. Well, we know where he is, and we walk away going, yelling at the screen going, he's in the hole. He's in the hole. You were right there.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if the bow, it can go
it's,
way, right?
But like what's good, it's a bit, it's about as good as a bow as we can hope for, because at the end of the day, he's going to jail, probably go to hospital. Yeah. He'll learn that his daughter's okay, which is like the only small mercy that he has, but he has to go to jail and bear the burden.
Essentially, torture the poor kid for
only,
no reason.
Not only torturing someone, but essentially torturing someone who could have been his daughter, into being a pawn in the game of those things. So he's got even more psychological burden on that. But I do love that he at least, you know, his survivalist instincts meant that he had a torch on his keys, meant that he found a whistle. And then after, and they're playing, there's a great, you know, transition phase where they go from like in situ, they go from sort of like soundtrack music of Radiohead to like these guys are listening to Radiohead at the building site. Like, it's just a great transition, just a beautiful little musical edit. And then they play it and, you know, we hear the whistle and it's just like,
a lovely touch again of just the workmanlike nature of them doing their work. They're like, oh, the ground's frozen. Boom. We'll just like, literally it's knockoff time. Yep. Not like, we're going to be here all night till we get our man. Especially with the guy that plays the head of the crime scene investigators is great as well, where he's like, when he walks him through the book and he goes, yeah, I read it. It's fine. You know, I read a few chapters of the book. And then when he's like, Lurky's like, I don't know what to do. He's like, keep knocking on doors, looking in windows. I love that. Like, just that idea of like, you're a detective. Just go keep, like, it's no different to what they sort of.
Well, that brings it down to the ground. It brings it down to the ground level. Whereas there are other points in the film where it kind of, some of the stuff with the spirals and all the mazes and the larger scale where they're essentially what they call, there was a movie years ago with Ben Kingsley and Aaron Eckhart called Suspect Zero, which was about a truck driver who was essentially responsible for killing strays and wanderers and homeless and stuff, and like hundreds of people and all that sort of thing. And so this was trying to do something, when it was trying to do this bigger scale thing of, oh, these guys are responsible for all the child killings and for like the last 30 years. Yeah. It does feel like it escapes control a bit. That's the one part of the film where it feels like it's a bit out of Villeneuve's control. It's kind of
as soon as they mention it, he's just like, it's almost like I have to mention it because it's a good note. But then the smartest thing he does is, no, and now I have to get even tighter on this story. And then it becomes about like, it's every, like, as I think Stu put it really well, is like everyone's being pushed and the noose is tightening and it just gets tighter and tighter and tighter, and then we're here.
Because there's that cynicism in Seven where Morgan Freeman's like, we just go around, we pick up the pieces that are never going to be used, and we label everything, and we one day may build a case. And I think that has been a nice reset point for that sort of modern day gritty detective film, when it is things like this, where it's Loki just, I am literally walking around with a notepad saying, what happened? Oh, yeah, window. And the way they tie it back in, it is a bit tropey, but he's like, comes back to window, open, find the sock.
Yeah,
like it is about just sweating the case, even tying back to how you know, from following Hugh Jackman to the liquor store where he's going to cut through. There were those nice scripty kind of moments. But at some point, these things have to happen, right? Like,
yeah.
And I guess it also looks at those, if they have been out, because you get the sense they were quite younger when they were out knocking off kids, that it is a time before it was just people going missing and weren't run amok because...
And they're a town over. You know, if they're a town
over... Yeah, there's no computers linking missing people. And
it's like they got missing and if they can't find them, a poor single mum.
No surveillance and stuff.
Poor single mum with a family. It's just like they just never know the kid goes missing. And then like 5 years later, she could see her son on the news or in the shop and never even know that it's her son. She has no clue. She doesn't know what they're going to look like.
Touches of black phone from last year, like how about the kids going. With that sort of thing, the ease of just kids getting nabbed, which was more of a time of the 80s, like 70s, 80s kind of thing, was that lurking idea that people could.
But there was always that thing because you don't know what's behind that, you know, that door or that house. That, you know, there was always that weird. Every neighborhood had a weird house. There was always someone there that was just a little off.
What's on the edge of the footy field? Like that kind of thing. Like that car that's occasionally seen up the back paddock kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think it echoes at those things really smartly, like it just really tight. Because otherwise, you're into True Detective and you're doing the Yellow King.
Yeah,
and we never really get to the bottom of the Yellow King, and we stumble onto everything else along the way. And
it's also you can't sort of do it nowadays. 10 days, you know, 10 years later, it's like everyone's photographing everything. You know, it's all everything's on social media. There's all, you know, you don't worry about people that missing because I can just photograph and post it on Instagram, for God's sake.
Well, and it's probably one thing we didn't, again, just sort of jumping back to Iron Man very quickly, in that was like some phones and it was like they were more text messages than there. I don't think there are any video phones. In this, that everyone's got a flip phone, it feels like that is that tail end.
It's just that it's that transition point. It's that early 2000s, you know, this movie is looking back probably about 5-10 years. It's like that early 2000s pre-2010 when there's like not everyone has an iPhone. Like not everyone has all those things. They've just got this old school technology. Not everyone's taking photos. Social media isn't omnipresent. It's just like not quite there yet. And even
Not even text messages are a thing. Like, it's not even like, where are you? They're literally opened to call. And if I don't get a call, it's not even like, because it wasn't.
No, because it takes so long to cycle through three letters. Where? It's like, where? You're cycling through the letters.
And 40. Now everybody has a GPS in their pocket. It's like,
it's a different thing. But I think one of the things that we can say, though, it's been 10 years, we've touched on a couple of them. One of the things we can say is anyone who was buying stock on Danny Villeneuve at this time is earning. They are earning.
Oh, yeah. Eating well.
They're eating well. Steak dinners a lot.
And same with, I was last week talking with people about Prince of Persia, and I only caught that maybe 2 years ago. Like, I think it was on Disney Plus. Like, I saw it on Disney Plus going, I'm going to finally watch it because I've always heard it was horrible. But what Gyllenhaal actually brings to that is quite fun. Like, it feels like it remembers a time again of 40 years. It feels like it's the last time a bit. That and sort of Pirates of the Caribbean feel like the last of the swashbuckling can still remember the rope swinging, jumping out of harm's way. But Gyllenhaal has such a odd charisma to that kind of, like, because it's either going to be the shitbag rogue or it's him who's this sort of, it's a quirkiness of sort of the thief out of time and place, which also works in his own way. The same way it worked in that, or it works in Spider-Man, or he can crank it up for Nightcrawler.
Or Ambulance. Absolutely having a ball. He's having a ball.
But it's sort of it's this different time, though. It's because the thing with Gyllenhaal is always it's the eyes and the hair. Gyllenhaal does all that stuff through those. And he uses them both to great effect in this film. And it's sort of like that this was that period where he was like early 30s. So he's transitioned from being the young, pretty boy from like, you know, the hunk sort of thing, the Day After Tomorrow and that kind of stuff, to more, this is where he starts getting the juiciest sort of roles and being a real dramatic sort of adult actor. And it's an odd one because he's, yeah.
Because we just watched, and it's also
Gyllenhaal pre-Taylor Swift. It's pre-Taylor Swift.
It's probably arguably his like, you know, as the gay man on this thing, I've got to say, it's arguably his hottest period.
No, he's hot.
We were watching Brokeback, and even just seeing the, like, how much more in control of his craft is in this, just in that time period. Like, just he's really, the way he's sort of really zoned in. Like, even that opening shot of just him, and again, it's partially direction and whatnot, but the way he is hunched over that table, again, he's showing, like, that's the way he's sort of hunched forward on that table is a person who's eaten with a certain degree of, that's, again, that boy home style protection. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm kind of like, I've got to look, like, it's almost that you'd, if he was someone who'd come out of prison and was in that similar sort of room in a diner, you'd expect him to eat in a similar way. Like that sort of like, I'm looking after my...
That's the Jason Bourne thing where it's like, it's 20 meters to the exit.
Yeah. He actually probably would have made an interesting Bourne too, just quietly.
I think you could do a Bourne.
Yeah.
So 10 years, Jake Gyllenhaal's stock, still high.
And getting higher.
We'll see how Roadhouse is.
Hugh Jackman. This was kind of peak Hugh Jackman. He'd like kind of crested.
Is it his best? Is this his best work? Or is Logan? Will Logan go?
Maybe
down
Logan. I think maybe Logan plays out for him.
I'm a fan of his, The Prestige.
Prestige is spectacular. Yeah.
Is this too big? Like, does he go? Because I think he, for all of his charm, I think Hugh Jackman is probably very limited in what he can do. He can do affable, nice guy. Or rage. He does a bit of sort of smarmy shitbag when he's trying to lie about, you know, going to have a drink and stuff. Him swigging the whiskey is a bit like watching Tom Cruise drink a beer in Mission Impossible 3. You guys have never had a drink in your life. Like, he's like, can I swig it? And it's like, you know, he's drinking... Like Denzel drinks vodka in Flight. He's like, look at me chug vodka because I'm such an alcoholic. It's, you know, I think it would be it'd be close to some of Hugh Jackman's.
Yeah, I think it's definitely close. Like, I would just say this movie is aging particularly well because it feels like something we don't have anymore. It feels like right in the pocket. One of those last gasps at an earlier age, as you said, Garth, you know, it'd be a Paramount movie. It'd be a Paramount filler from the 90s, which I, you know, is such an amazing collection of words for all of the pictures that it conjures in my head of all of the memories of all those.
the double jeopardies, the kiss the girls, like dirty
touchstone pictures.
It's just something. It just grabs me. But yeah, I think this movie, what it's done is, you know, in some ways, I feel like at the time it was probably maligned as like a, you know, this is like a kind of prestige-y kind of Seven. I mean, Seven did, you know, for the whole serial killer kind of movie or these kind of movies, like it really broke the mold. It was a genre buster and it took a long time for people to recover. But I think what's happened in the last 10 years is that rather than just diminishing them for maybe being in the same genre area as a great movie, I think people go back and can actually like find the differentiation of why this is so good. Like, it's just like, it's really good. It sits up there. We spoke about Gone Girl. We've spoken about Nightcrawler. You know, and
Dance of the Land.
Literally on IMDb, it's AI or whatever algorithm. It says more like this. If you're just looking at this movie and it says Nightcrawler, Gone Girl, says Shutter Island, which is another terrific one. Seven. It says The Prestige, Zodiac, Catch Me If You Can. I'm like, Catch Me If You Can is a bit jaunty. It's a little bit more jaunty than what I think. But yeah, it's definitely like, it's got a whole bunch of other movies that it's recommending.
Fewer kids got raped in Catch Me If You Can from memory. Like, probably because he never caught him.
That's what Spielberg is known for.
And Hanks. Spielberg and Hanks.
Yeah.
Not two words, children and rape, I would think with those guys' names ever.
Leo, you've slipped through my clutches yet again.
And just when I thought we were going to go out with a bit of prestige talking about prisoners, you bring down the class. Gentlemen, thank you so much for doing this. This is a really fun exercise, I think, because, you know, as I said, part of my desire to do this was like an old Anthony Lane quote where he talked about, you know, you should watch the movies and review them on the opening day. And his mind is like, or you shouldn't talk about them for 50 years. And I'm not quite as patient as Anthony Lane to wait 50 years for some of these movies that I want to talk about from 10 years ago. But I certainly want to go back and revisit, because I feel like anything that's still resonating pretty strongly with me from like more than a decade, especially, you know, because that was the time when I kind of really started getting into film criticism, I'm just excited to, you know, check out the ones that I love and see if they've still got any lasting cultural impacts or if people are finding them. Because this feels like really, you know, a 10-year rolling window. It feels like the last, you know, parts of relevancy that we actually see manifest on like streaming services and stuff like that, you know, like they just kind of like, it's like 10 years and then beyond 10 years, there's like three movies that were made in every other decade. And that's it. That's all that streaming services have, unless it's the Criterion Channel or something like that. But it feels like there's so few of those movies that maybe, you know, in the last couple of decades that it goes beyond.
It also maybe sort of reminds everyone to chill out and not many years are bad years for cinema.
Yeah.
Like you can go basically through any year and you're going to find your 20 or 30 titles that you're like, yeah, I had a ball. And that like everyone gets so anxious about, oh, seven things came out yesterday. I haven't seen them yet. And you're like, just relax. Like these things, like just calm down. There's going to be oodles of time to
listen.
To catch
I try and be an adult.
It's so much easier. You have so much easier access now than you did 10 years ago. It's not like exactly. It's going to be hard.
No.
And look, I do try and be an adult, but you know, like we just were talking about off air. Give me that Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning trailer, baby. Oh my God. I know I should be an adult. I shouldn't carry on, but God.
Yeah, but it's Rebecca Ferguson and I patching you.
I didn't know that was a kink until it came up on screen.
I love finding new kinks in trailers. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. You can find Garth at Dark Horizons every day, every fucking day. The man is a machine. He's the T-1000 of movie news online, and just like Robert Patrick, he will chase you down on a motorbike and catch you. He'll be so fast that James Cameron has to tell you to slow down so you don't catch the bike. Stu Coote, always being a pest in the best possible way, always making me chuckle. I have to actually share his own tweets back to him in text messages to respond to them, because my public response would absolutely get me canceled. So bless your heart, Stu Coote, and just stay you, you know?
My pleasure.
It feels like such a 20th century movie. It feels like something David Lean would have done or tried to do when he still had that kind of currency. And even then, he might not have succeeded.
It's incredible because, like, if you don't have time to watch all five seasons of Lost, you can just watch Fearless.
Not a week goes by that I don't think of the ending of Gallipoli. It's left a mark. A Year of Living Dangerously. You know, and then something like Last Wave, even, that's so deeply embedded with the land and the story of the land, the story of place. You know, I don't know that I'd seen very many movies at that point in my life that had such a down ending, and they had such a, you know, sort of strong sense of folklore attached to it as that. And something always so poetic and lyrical about Peter Weir's work.
Gallipoli was the first movie that ever traumatized me, and I don't think I ever really recovered from it. And I'm still upset that they played it in school. Like, I don't think it's actually possible to make an anti-war movie, but I think Peter Weir pulled it off.
Yes.
Because no one watches that movie then thinks, I want to go to war.
Peter Weir is the greatest director that Australia has ever produced. Like, bar none, hands down. Like, no one else is even in the room.
I think you have covered some really titanic filmmakers and some really titanic films so far. But I truly think what makes Peter Weir special and what makes you doing this one special is we don't talk about Peter Weir that way, and we should. Peter Weir is one of those guys who I don't get why he isn't a bigger name, why he isn't more in that rarefied air.
Yes.
Because I think film for film, he's one of our very best filmmakers. He has brought his A game repeatedly to many properties. There are films of his that I hold very dear. Fearless, The Mosquito Coast. I will fight somebody if they talk bad about The Mosquito Coast. It's, man, I love that movie. But in general, I just think he is a special filmmaker, a smart, lyrical, hallucinatory filmmaker. He's a very dreamy filmmaker, and I don't think he gets his due.
You know, Master and Commander is one of my all-time favorite movies. Easily one of the best movies of the last 20 years. It's, it's a grand scale. There's a historical backdrop to it, but at the same time, there's such an intimacy in the relationships.
Which I think is not just a great film and one of the last great epics in the truest sense. I think is actually kind of a sliding doors change point moment in cinema history. I think 2003, when that comes along and it is an old-fashioned, we don't make them like that anymore type film. I think if Master and Commander spawns a franchise at that point, the entire cinema landscape globally is completely different.
That's the movie that I wanted to see 10 of those, I know they're big fans of Fast and Furious and everything, and God bless you, but Master and Commander should have been.
It's one of those things, again, I'm not a seafaring man, sir. But there is a sense of authenticity. There's a sense of really watching a genuine dedication to recreating history unfold on a big screen in front of you that can't help but inspire just genuine admiration and awe.
If you're going to pick a film where he really brings every one of his skills to the table, it's Master and Commander. I think you picked the right one, man.
Yeah, very excited to see what you pull out of this, Blake.
That's right. Our next series is Peter Weir and Russell Crowe's Master and Commander. The series is called Podcaster and Commander.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.